I'd say I'm really glad and proud to be here tonight. True love is hard to find. Sometimes you think you have true love, and then you catch the early flight home from San Diego, and a couple of new people jump out of your bathroom blindfolded like a goddamn magic show, ready to double-team your girlfriend. And it stops
right there. And it continues right here, because I think what my friend Mitch is trying to say is that true love is blind. Let's raise our glasses, whatever we got in front of us. Salute. Health and happiness. Cheers, everybody. I love you so much, Frankie. I love you.
What is going on? Welcome to another edition of the Exiled Clevelander podcast, episode 10. I am your host, Adam Copeland. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a while since we've last talked, but the good news about that is it gives us a lot to talk about this time, and we're going to get into the Browns, the Tribe, the Cavs, even some Buckeye basketball in an extended version of Ask the Exiled Clevelander coming up in a little bit. But first, I want to talk about the NBA trade deadline, because this was a very big NBA trade deadline for the Cleveland Cavaliers and their now fully consummated rebuilding project. And it's funny because last year at the NBA trade deadline, we were rejoicing over Antoine Jameson's arrival from the Wizards and hoping that he was going to be the missing piece to the championship puzzle. Flash forward a year later, and the Cavs have the worst record in the NBA, and it's all about getting more draft picks to go with a surefire high lottery pick that the Cavs are going to get here due to their record. And it's just a testament to how far we have fallen and how bleak the Cleveland landscape is as we look at where we were just a year ago around this time with the Cavs. So the Cavs were able to land what is likely going to be a lottery pick by trading Mo Williams and Jamaria Moon to the Los Angeles Clippers for their number one pick in this year's draft, and the Cavs also get point guard Baron Davis. In acquiring Davis, the Cavs get a player with a large contract, and many have stated a questionable work ethic. This season, he has averages of 12.8 points and 7 assists in 43 games this season. Those are career low averages. And when you compare it to Mo Williams, who is averaging 13.3 points and 7.1 assists in 36 games, it's technically a bit of statistical downgrade there. Also somewhat troubling, Davis is set to make $13.95 million next year, $14.85 million the following year. That's approximately $12 million more than Mo Williams was set to make over those last 2 years of his contract if he exercised his player options. And on the surface, that seems like a lot to pay for a guy who is often accused of checking out for games or even stretches of the season. And unfortunately, that has been a problem for this Cavaliers team generally under first-year coach Byron Scott. And incidentally, Scott and Davis did not get along very well in their first stint together with the New Orleans Hornets, though both men now claim in the media that they are doing just fine and that that's not going to be a problem. So Davis comes to Cleveland, but this deal really isn't about Baron Davis. Whatever Davis gives you is sort of gravy in this deal. It's about getting another lottery pick, and at the end, that's why I like the deal. Davis is unlikely to be a core piece of the team going into the future, and I'm not even sure if he's going to finish the remainder of his 2 years of that contract with the Cavs. Wouldn't surprise me if some point down the line he's bought out or he's unloaded as an expiring deal in another trade a year or two down the road. But the Cavs are in desperate need of core pieces. There is a serious talent deficiency on this team, and acquiring another high draft pick, as they've done with this trade, gives the Cavs a chance to assemble some core pieces. Some have criticized this trade because this year's draft is generally regarded as a weak one, And it's a draft that could get even weaker if there's an NBA lockout and some of the guys who were thinking about coming out of school decide to stay in school to see how the labor situation plays out. And I think that that's a legitimate argument. This is unlikely to be a particularly strong draft, and it does not appear to have any sort of franchise-saving superstar when you look at who is likely to be available. That said, in every draft, there are pieces that can be acquired. There are talented players, and the Cavs now have a chance with two picks that are likely to be in the top 10 of this draft to add two young contributors and start really building a young core. And that's something that the Cavs never did during the LeBron James era. It's the reason why some people have said that LeBron ultimately left, because they couldn't surround him with a young core. So these two lottery picks give them the chance to start building that young core now. And I just see very little downside in this trade. Mo Williams was psychologically devastated by the decision, and he was a shell of the player he had been. He had had a hard time staying healthy. Jamario Moon had really faded to the background. It seemed like he didn't really have Byron Scott's trust, and there were rumors that Moon was going to be cut anyway, even if he wasn't traded. So even if Davis turns out to be a spectacular bust, I don't think it's really going to matter. The added pick cost Dan Gilbert about $12 million, but the Cavs still maintain salary cap flexibility, and they still have the full traded player exception that they received from Miami in the LeBron trade. And the Cavs can use that traded player exception probably in the offseason now to acquire more draft picks and or more players. So if, like I said before, if Davis ends up being productive, it's pretty much gravy on top of getting that lottery pick. So the trade with the Clippers was the headline. In a more minor deal, the Cavs traded a second-round pick in 2013 to Boston. That was a pick they acquired from Minnesota in the Delonte West trade over the summer. And they trade that pick to Boston for rookie center Semi Erden and rookie forward Luke Herangoodie. Erden is a 6'9 center, averaging 14.4 minutes with 4.1 points and 2.9 rebounds and a half a block per game. He's done that over 37 appearances. Herangoodie, also a rookie, averaging 8.6 minutes for the Celtics, 2.3 points, 2 rebounds, and 28 appearances. This deal has all upside and virtually no downside. Cavs can take a flyer on a couple of young guys who could very easily crack the Cavs' youthful rotation, and they barely had to give up anything of consequence to do it. Just a second-round pick 2 years down the road. Boston, I think, was willing to do this to free up some roster space for possible veteran additions as they head down the road here towards a possible championship run. And the Cavs were a willing participant in being able to take the young kids off the Celtics' hands. And it's kind of an interesting deal, because the Cavs were reportedly targeting Erden in a possible trade with the Celtics that would have involved Anthony Parker. Parker is still with the Cavs, despite the fact that he was the subject of a lot of trade speculation with suitors, including the Celtics and possibly the Bulls. And supposedly the Cavs weren't able to find a deal they found acceptable for him, which sort of leaves me dumbfounded. This guy is older. He's not going to be a part of that young core that I've been talking about. He's taking minutes away from younger guys, and he was supposedly in some demand. So as long as the Cavs weren't going to take back salary for him, I would have dumped Parker for a low second-round pick, and that would have at least been something to show for a guy who is unlikely to be in a Cavs uniform next year, and even if he is re-signed, that's purely as a stopgap measure. So the fact that the Cavs got Erden, who is the player they were targeting in the Parker trade, makes the fact that Parker's still with the team a little more palatable, but I feel like the Cavs probably left something on the table there that they could have acquired by trading Anthony Parker. But the bottom line on the trades that the Cavs did make is that they've created some opportunities to build in the long term with both players and draft picks. And we're now finally seeing with these trades that the official rebuilding project of the Cleveland Cavaliers has begun. And we can only hope that Dan Gilbert and Chris Grant can now go about executing this rebuilding project the right way. From the looks of what they've done so far, I think they're off to a good start. So since the last show, I've been fortunate enough to receive several questions in the exiledclevelander at gmail.com mailbox for the Ask the Exiled Clevelander segment. And there's a lot of good stuff to talk about. So let's get to it.
I'll answer. You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
Ask the Exiled Clevelander.
You want answers? I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
So the first question comes from Aaron. He writes, Adam, what are your thoughts on the Browns' new coaching staff? I'm a little concerned about a first-year head coach like Shurmur calling the plays without an offensive coordinator. Well, first on the coaching staff issue, the Browns hired Dick Geron as their defensive coordinator, and he's going to be assisted in that capacity by Ray Rhodes, the former NFL head coach and defensive coordinator. And I think that those are both solid hires. Shurmur doesn't have any experience coaching the defensive side of the ball. He is a first-year head coach. So at the very least, the Browns needed to put in place individuals on the defensive side of the ball that could just handle the defense so that, by and large, Shurmur would not have to worry about that. And in putting two former NFL head coaches and two guys who are also defensive coordinators in the league, I think that they've probably done that. You could argue a little bit that Geron's record isn't particularly impressive as either a head coach or defensive coordinator, but he was probably the best guy available for the job. He knows the type of systems that the Mike Holmgren teams like to run. And again, I think that they probably made the best of the situation given who was available. Special teams coordinator is going to be Chris Tabor. He's going to replace Brad Seeley, who was very highly regarded as a special teams coach. Seeley goes over to San Francisco. Tabor was an assistant with the Bears. If you're to believe Lovie Smith, he's really going to miss Tabor's contributions, and the Bears had a pretty solid special teams unit. We'll see how the Browns special teams perform. I think that Seeley had the advantage the last couple years of Eric Mangini being a huge special teams guy, so there was a large emphasis on the types of special teams players that the Browns were bringing in. We'll see if Shurmur has that same luck with special teams. I think that's less about coaching than it is about the personnel that you have. I think Heckert is of the philosophy that it matters more the skill players you have on offense and defense than your special teams type gunners. But Tabor seems like a solid enough hire. Special teams coordinators aren't typically going to win or lose you many games, though you could argue that Seeley's special teams plan in the New Orleans game was pretty decisive, at least in one game this year. So that brings me to the second part of Aaron's question, which deals with Pat Shurmur calling the plays without an offensive coordinator. I think it's kind of an overblown concern. You look at Packers coach Mike McCarthy, Saints coach Sean Payton are two examples of guys who call the plays as head coaches, and they also happen to be the last two head coaches to win the Super Bowl. So this is what coaches from the Mike Holmgren tree typically do, and they typically have success with it. The Browns also brought in Mark Whipple to be the quarterback's coach, and he was an offensive coordinator down at the University of Miami. Plus, they have Gil Haskell, who's an offensive mind who worked with Holmgren as an offensive coordinator, and then they have Holmgren himself for offensive philosophy up in the front office. So I think that there are plenty of offensive minds to go around on this team, not too concerned with Shurmur calling the plays. I think the bigger concern with the Browns coaching staff is the fact that they're looking to implement two brand new systems in the 4-3 and the West Coast offense, and they're looking to do it in an offseason that might be significantly shortened or eliminated altogether with a potential NFL labor work stoppage. As of this recording, which is at the end of February, the situation is not looking good. The sides are in federal mediation right now, and by the mediator's own quotes, they're far apart on all the major issues. So an owner's lockout looks like it's very likely to occur. And if it occurs, I think it's very fair to criticize Mike Holmgren about the coaching decisions that he made, not necessarily with the guys he brought in, but the fact that he waited a year to go ahead and remove Eric Mangini with this lockout on the horizon. If he fires Mangini when he comes in, then he has a whole season with his guys to implement that system before a potential lockout. Instead, he decided to bring back Mangini, either because he had faith in Mangini or didn't think he had a better option or whatever. But now Shermer is in. He's going to be looking to implement the West Coast office. Jerome is in. He's going to be looking to switch from Mangini's 3-4 to a 4-3 defense. And the Browns may not have any real offseason to do it. So even if this labor situation gets resolved, and even if we don't lose any actual regular season games, the OTA periods, a full training camp, that's when the players get familiar with new systems, and the Browns are unlikely to have that type of developmental period. So the coaches may end up being great hires, and I think it'll be difficult to judge them either way this season because they're not going to have the benefit of that full off season. And for that, the blame falls on Mike Holmgren, unfortunately. So the second question I've got here is from Robert. He emails, Adam, I enjoyed the podcast, but you've got to have some thoughts on the Cavs losing streak, which is 24 games as I'm writing you. Is this the worst NBA team you've ever seen? Well, as we all know, it got worse after Robert emailed me. They lost another couple of games to set the all-time NBA losing record at 26, tying the Tampa Bay Buccaneers team for the all-time sports record in losses. Important distinction, though, the Cavs did it all in one season. I'm not sure if that's ever going to be broken again. I mean, it was downright painful. I don't know if they were the worst NBA team I've ever seen, but win-loss record, they certainly were. And the frustrating part about this team throughout most of that stretch was that I'd say in 80% of the games, the effort was just not up to snuff. And I can live with the Cavs losing because of lack of talent. That's going to happen when you're in a rebuilding project, and it's honestly not the worst thing, because in the NBA, if you're terrible, you have a chance of to rebuild quicker through the draft. But it is very difficult as a fan to respect a team that just cannot go out there on a night-to-night basis and compete. And you could tell Byron Scott, from his very vocal quotes in the media, was extremely upset with the team's effort level. And I think it's a debate for another day what Byron Scott's role in all of that was, and it's a debate that I'd like to have. But ever since December 2nd, when the Miami Heat came to town, this team has just been sort of psychologically out of it. And you'll recall my discussion with Brendan Bowers of Step In Rules that game seemed to really kill the Cavs' psyches. And it lasted all the way through that losing streak. Now it's been kind of interesting. They beat the New York Knicks on Friday. And before that, they beat the LA Lakers. They snapped that losing streak against the LA Clippers, and the game immediately after the All-Star break, they competed pretty well against the Houston Rockets. So they're winning some games. They're playing significantly harder. Their heads seem to be into it. So they are redeeming themselves, I think, a little bit here, and you're getting to see some of the younger players like J.J. Hickson finally stepping up. Ramon Sessions is playing significantly better now that he's been given a chance to play major minutes. And it's a somewhat intriguing team now for the remainder of this season to see hopefully they can build something going into the next season, though it's kind of a double-edged sword. You want to see them build something for that next season, but you also don't want to see them play themselves out of the top pick, or at least the most lottery balls in this upcoming draft. So I didn't have a podcast about it because, I mean, what are you going to say? There's only so much you can say about a team that doesn't want to give effort. This was a very painful team to watch. It was a team that I really didn't like watching. In fact, I tweeted at one point that I really hated this Cavs team because they seemed to show no heart and no respect for the game. That's, I think, changed a little bit in these last few games, and I'm not sure what's changed it, and I'm not sure if it's going to continue. But all I ask from the Cavs, and all I think we can ask as sports fans, is that the players try their hardest and act like professionals. And it appears right now like the Cavs are back to doing that. Next question comes from Jenny. She says, Adam, I really like the show, but how about some love for the best team in Ohio, the Ohio State basketball team? Well, Jenny, thanks for the question. I have a little confession here. I haven't always followed the Ohio State basketball team all that closely. I'm not an alumnus of the Ohio State University. Grew up as a diehard Ohio State football fan. We always followed Buckeye football in my house, but we didn't really follow Buckeye basketball that closely. And I went to school at George Washington here in the Washington, D.C. area, where they had a pretty competitive basketball team by the time I graduated. They were, believe it or not, a top 10 team the year after I graduated from GW. So Ohio State, I've rooted for them in basketball, but haven't been as active of a fan. So that's why you're probably not going to see a ton of Ohio State content on this podcast in terms of basketball. But I do think it merits some discussion. You're right. They are the best team in Ohio. They're 26-2 and ranked third in the country at the time of this recording. And they look like a real championship contender. They've certainly got my attention. And they're a fun team to root for because they play fundamentally sound basketball. They make good decisions at both ends of the court. They play defense very hard, which is always nice to see in any team at any level. And they run their offensive sets in a pretty efficient way. And they've got an NBA-level talent in Jared Sollinger. So they're a fun team to watch. And I think that they have a chance to go to the Final Four. They have a chance. They have a chance to win the championship. As great as an event as the NCAA tournament is, it is kind of a crapshoot because you can run into a hot shooting team one day and just lose. And that's kind of what has happened in the Buckeyes' two losses to Wisconsin and Purdue this year on the road. But in terms of the five players that they rely on the most, Aaron Kraft, John Diebler, David Leidy, William Buford, and of course Jared Sollinger, those five I think can go with any five in America in college basketball. So the Buckeyes are certainly going to be in that conversation. They will probably be a number one seed come NCAA tournament time. Some have worried about this team that there is not enough depth. You've only got seven players right now on this team who are averaging more than 14 minutes, with Deshaun Thomas and Dallas Lauderdale also contributing. But it's not a very large rotation that Coach Thad Matta is using. I think that those worries are probably not that big of a deal, especially come NCAA tournament time. Could be a concern in the Big Ten tournament, where you have to play game after game after game consecutively. Though a similarly thin Ohio State Buckeye team did win the Big Ten tournament last year behind Evan Turner's effort, so I don't think it's out of the question. And when you get to the NCAA tournament, you never play games 2 days in a row. You get a day off between the first round game and the second round game, and then you get 4 days off or even more between the second round game and the third round game if you make it that far. So I think the depth concerns are probably not that big of a deal. But as I said before, it's going to take some luck. It always does in the NCAA tournament. That's why they call it March Madness, because crazy things happen. And when you have a chance, one chance, to go up against a team, if you do get hot, if you get some breaks, if you get a player like Jared Sollinger in foul trouble early in the game, you can swing it your way. It's what makes the event so exciting as a basketball fan, and it's what makes it, I think, frustrating for programs that have an elite track record, because the best team doesn't always win. It's usually the best team that has the most luck. So we'll see if Ohio State has that luck, but I think they'll be in the conversation for the title at the end of this thing. I think they have a really good chance of making the Final Four and as good a chance as any team in America of winning the title. So, Jenny, I hope we are talking more basketball, more Ohio State basketball, as their season progresses, because that means that they're probably doing a lot of good things, and I look forward to talking about those good things that they're hopefully doing. Got a question here from Dave, who says, I have a question for Ask the Exile Clevelander. The Cavs are terrible, and who knows when we're going to see football again, so I guess we better start talking about the Indians. What do you think of what the Tribe did in free agency, and should they have done more? Tough to say that they should have done more, because Larry Dolan wasn't going to pay for it in any event. The two big things that they did, if you want to call it that, is they brought back Austin Kearns, who they traded to the Yankees in midseason. They bring him back to be an outfielder, and they signed veteran infielder Orlando Cabrera, and it looks like he's going to play second base. you know, it would have been nice to do more, but it's pretty clear at this point that the way this team is going to develop is by letting their kids play and their prospects develop and letting them take over. It's going to be like the Tampa Bay Devil Rays model, where they don't sign free agents, they don't make a lot of spending commitments, they draft well, hopefully, and let their prospects work their way up the system, and hopefully they arrive all at the same time. That's kind of this small market major league model now. You hope you get lightning in a bottle. And in the meantime, free agency you use basically for veteran fill-ins, which is what Kearns and Cabrera are. I will say this about those two signings that I like, and it's that they're not really taking away at-bats and playing time from promising prospects who are ready for the majors. Contrast that to what they did last year when they brought in Russell Branyan, which made no sense because Branyan had Matt LaPorta playing right behind him and potentially Jordan Brown as well. You know, Kearns with Grady Sizemore being hurt, the Indians do have a need for another outfielder. They don't have another major league ready outfielder in AAA who just needs to get at bats and needs to get major league exposure. So I don't really think that it's a bad move bringing in Kearns. Similarly for Cabrera, they're not paying him a lot, only $1 million this year. And he can come in, give you probably like a .250 batting average, but an above average glove at the second base position, even though he's a natural shortstop. They want Estrubel Cabrera to see if he can really take hold of that position. I think that makes sense. And they bring in Cabrera to play second base. The Indians do have a couple of infield prospects in Cord Phelps and Jason Kipnis and Lonnie Chisenhall, but none of those guys appear to be major league ready. So Cabrera is a stopgap, and if one of those guys has a phenomenal season in AAA and they want to bring him up at some point, you can make Cabrera into a utility type infielder, or you could possibly, if he has a good season, trade him away to a contender and get some more pieces back that way. So I'm not going to give the Indians a ton of credit for what they've done in the offseason, but I also don't think that they deserve a lot of criticism. Chris Antonetti did, I think, probably the best that he could have done given the budgetary restrictions that his owner has on him. Finally, we've got Hal, who writes, "Adam, I enjoy the program a lot, especially when you have Ryan on. You guys have great discussions. I hope that you'll continue to have him on the podcast. But my question is, do you think Eric Mangini's tenure looks a little better now that we've seen the way the NFL playoffs have played out? A lot of people accused the team of quitting on Mangini and pointed to the Baltimore and Pittsburgh games as evidence of that. But as it turns out, Baltimore and Pittsburgh were two of the best teams in the NFL. Do you think that there's any reason to reevaluate the tenure of Eric Mangini?" Well, I'm sure Ryan appreciates your comment, Hal, and there are plans to keep having him on the show. As for your question, I see where you're coming from. The Browns played a lot of skilled teams last year. They had one of the toughest schedules in the NFL by the statistics, and it's probably not necessarily fair to judge the Browns on their overall effort by losing to two talented teams like Baltimore and Pittsburgh, but I don't think you judge Eric Mangini's season based on those Baltimore and Pittsburgh games. I think it's more fair to judge them based on what happened in the games right before then against Buffalo and Cincinnati, two games against two reeling teams that the Browns ended up losing. And you really felt like if the Browns had been completely mentally in that game, if they had been playing as hard for Eric Mangini as they had been at other points this season and the season before that, those are games that they should have been able to take care of, and they just simply couldn't. So, yeah, Baltimore and Pittsburgh were good teams, but I think Mike Holmgren was justified in letting Eric Mangini go because the team was just not showing improvement. You need to, at the very least, be competitive with Baltimore and Pittsburgh. They're the class of the division and, to a lesser extent, the class of the NFL, and the Browns just have not been able to do that on a consistent basis. As I said earlier with regards to the Shurmur question, my concern was not so much that the Browns let go of Mangini, but the fact that it took them an additional season to pull the trigger and the consequences that that is going to have for this football team as we head towards a potential NFL lockout. That is the biggest question right now facing the Browns. How much is the labor stoppage going to interfere with Mike Holmgren and Pat Shurmur's refashioning of this football team? So Browns fans, you need to be rooting harder than I think maybe any other fan base in the NFL against a work stoppage, because the longer the work stoppage goes on, the more the Browns will be hurting. And before we wrap things up, just wanted to provide you with one more sweet reminder of why Cleveland sports are cursed. All of this Cleveland sports losing got me to thinking, when was the last time that at least two Cleveland teams in the major sports, Cavs, Browns, and Indians, actually had a winning record at the same time? Now, of course, all the seasons don't overlap all the time, but basketball overlaps a little bit with baseball in some period and football in others, and so on and so forth. So I got to researching this, and I found out the last time that two Cleveland teams had winning records was April 18th, 2007. The Cavaliers were heading to the playoffs. That was, of course, the year that they improbably made the NBA Finals. And April 18th happened to be the last day of the NBA regular season. They finished that season 50-32. They actually lost the game on the 18th to Milwaukee, 109-96. Your leading scorer, LeBron James. The Indians on April 18th, 2007, which was a special season for them. They made the ALCS before losing it to Boston. They were 6-5, had a winning record. They were actually playing at the New York Yankees that day and lost 9-2. Jeremy Sowers was your losing pitcher in New York on April 18th. But that's a pretty sad state of affairs. Of course, the caveat here applies that I'm only looking at regular seasons. If you wanted to go into the Cavs postseason run, technically they had a winning record at that time, and you could go into June if you really wanted to. The Cavs would have had a winning record, and the Indians had a winning record all the way through June. But I wanted to look at the regular season, and April 18th, 2007, almost 4 years ago, was the last time two Cleveland teams were playing in the regular season with winning records. And it's just another reason why Cleveland sports are cursed. So that'll just about do it for this edition of the Exiled Clevelander podcast. I want to express my thanks to Aaron, Robert, Jenny, Dave, and Hal for their questions, and also everyone else that wrote into exiledclevelander@gmail.com. If you have questions or comments about the podcast, please contact me there. Follow me on Twitter at exiledclevelander. That's exiled, C-L-E-V-E-L-N-D-R. One word on Twitter. Please look at the Facebook page. Just search for the Exiled Clevelander podcast on Facebook and like the page for show updates and other content. It's not pretty times in the Cleveland sports landscape, but there are things to talk about. We'll see how the Cavs finish out their season. We'll see how this NFL labor situation plays out to affect the Browns situation. And we're going to get some more substantial Indians talk now with spring training underway in Goodyear. So stay tuned for all that. Until then, I'm Adam Copeland. Thanks so much for listening to the Exiled Clevelander podcast.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.